His face was still. "And you," said Kieran, holding up a hand as Julian started forward, "stay where you are." "What have you done to him?" Julian's eyes flashed. "What have you done to my brother?"
"Mark belongs to the Wild Hunt," said Erloth. "If we choose to release him to you, it will be at our recognizance."
Arthur had sunk back into the chair behind him. He was blinking owlishly and looking from Mark to the fairy host. The gray color was back in his face.
"The dead rise and the lost return," he said. "We should fly blue banners from the tops of the towers."
Kieran seemed coldly puzzled. "Why does he say that?"
Julian looked from Arthur to Mark to the other two fairies. "He's in shock," he said. "His health is fragile. It has been since the war."
"It's from an old Shadow Hunter poem," said Emma. "I'm surprised you don't know it."
"Poems contain much truth," said Erloth, and there was humor in his voice, but a bitter sort. Emma wondered if he was laughing at them or himself.
Julian was staring at Mark, a look on his face of unmitigated shock and longing.
"Mark," he said.
Mark looked away. Julian looked as if he had been pierced by elf bolts, the sly fairy arrows that burrowed under the skin and released deadly poison. Any anger Emma had felt toward him about the night before evaporated. The look on his face was like knife blades in her heart.
"Mark," he said again, and then in a half whisper, "why? Why can't he speak to me?"
"He is forbidden by Gwen to speak until our bargain is sealed," said Kieran.
He glanced at Mark, and there was something cold in his expression. Hatred? Envy? Did he despise Mark for being half-human? Did they all? How had they showed their hate all these years, when Mark was at their mercy? Emma could sense how hard Julian was holding himself back from going to his brother. She spoke for him.
"So Mark is your bargaining chip?" Rage flashed across Kieran's face, sudden and startling.
"Why must you state things that are obvious? Why must all humans do it, foolish girl?"
Julian changed. His attention snapped away from Mark, his spine straightening, his voice hardening. He sounded calm, but Emma, who knew him so well, could hear the ice in his voice.
"Emma is my Parabatai," he said. "If you ever speak to her like that again, there will be blood on the floor of the sanctuary, and I do not care if they put me to death for it."
Kieran's beautiful alien eyes gleamed.
"You Nephilim are loyal to your chosen partners. I will give you that."
He waved a dismissive hand.
"I suppose Mark is our bargaining chip, as you put it, but do not forget that it is the fault of the Nephilim that we need one at all. There was a time when Shadow Hunters would have investigated the killings of our kind because they believed in their mandate to protect more than they believed in their hate."
"There was a time when the fair folk might have freely returned to us one of our own," said Arthur. "The pain of loss goes both ways, as does the loss of trust."
"Well, you will have to trust us," said Kieran. "You have no one else, do you?"
There was a long silence. Julian's gaze went back to his brother, and in that moment Emma hated the fair folk, for in holding Mark, they also held Julian's human breakable heart.
"So you want us to find out who was responsible for these killings," he said. "Stop the murders of fairies and humans, and in return you will give us Mark if we succeed?"
"The court is prepared to be far more generous," said Kieran.
"We will give you Mark now. He will assist you in your investigation, and when the investigation is over, he may choose whether he remains with you or returns to the hunt."
"He will choose us," said Julian. "We are his family." Kieran's eyes shone.
"I would not be so sure, young Shadow Hunter. Those of the hunt are loyal to the hunt."
"He isn't of the hunt," said Emma. "He's a Blackthorn."
"His mother, Lady Nerissa, was Fey," said Kieran. "And he has ridden with us, reaped the dead with us, mastered the use of elf bolt and arrow. He is a formidable warrior, in the fairy fashion. But he is not like you. He will not fight like you. He is not Nephilim."
"Yes, he is," said Julian. "Shadowhunter blood breeds true. His skin can bear marks. You know the laws."
Kieran did not reply to that, just looked at Arthur.
"Only the head of the Institute can decide this. You must let your uncle speak freely."
Emma looked to Arthur. They all did.
Arthur picked nervously, fretfully at the arm of his chair.
"You wish the Fayboy here that he might report on us to you," he said finally in a quavering voice. "He will be your spy."
The Fayboy, not Mark. Emma looked over at Mark, but if a flicker of hurt passed across his stony face, it was invisible.
"If we wish to spy on you, there are easier ways," said Kieran, in a tone of cold reproach. "We would not need to give up Mark. He is one of the best fighters of the hunt. Gwyn will miss him sorely. He will not be a spy."
Julian drew away from Emma, fell on his knees by his uncle's chair. He leaned in and whispered to Arthur, and Emma, strained to hear what he was saying, but could make out only a few words. "Brother, and investigation, and murder, and medicine, and clave." Arthur held up a shaking hand, as if to silence his nephew, and turned to the fairies.
"We will accept your offer," he said, "on the condition that there will be no tricks.
At the end of the investigation, when the killer is caught, Mark will make his own free choice to stay or to go."
"Of course," said Erloth. "As long as the murderer is clearly identified, we wish to know the one with the blood on his hands. It will not be enough for you to say it was done by that one or this one, or vampires were responsible. The murderer or murderers will be placed in the custody of the courts. We will mete out justice."
"Not if I find the murderer first," thought Emma. "I'll deliver his dead body to you, and that had better be good enough."
"First you swear," said Julian, his blue-green eyes bright and hard. "Say, I swear that when the terms of the bargain are fulfilled, Mark Blackthorne will make his own free choice whether he wishes to be part of the hunt or return to his life as a Nephilim."
Kieran's mouth tightened.
"I swear that when the terms of the bargain are fulfilled, Mark Blackthorne will make his own free choice whether he wishes to be part of the hunt or return to his life as a Nephilim."
Mark was expressionless, unmoving as he had been all this time, as if they weren't discussing him but someone else. He looked as if he were seeing through the walls of the sanctuary, seeing the distant ocean, perhaps, or a place even further away than that.
"Then I think we have an arrangement," Julian said. The two fairies looked at each other, and then Kieran walked over to Mark.
He laid his white hands on Mark's shoulders and said something to him in a guttural language Emma didn't understand. It was nothing Diana had taught them, not the high, fluting speech of the court fae, or any other magical speech. Mark didn't move, and Kieran stepped away, looking unsurprised.
"He's yours for now," he said.
"We will leave his steed for him.
They have become attached."
"He won't be able to use a horse," Julian said, his voice tight. "Not in Los Angeles."
Kieran's smile was full of contempt.
"I think you'll find he can use this one."
"God!" It was Arthur crying out. He lurched forward, his hands cradling his head. "It hurts!"
Julian moved to his uncle's side, reaching to grip his arm, but Arthur threw him off, rising to his feet, his breath uneven.
"I must excuse myself," he said. "My headache, it is unbearable."
He looked horribly unwell, it was true. His skin was the color of dirty chalk, his collar sticking to his throat with sweat.
Both Kieran and Irloth said nothing. Neither did Mark, who still stood swaying blindly on his feet. The Fae watched Arthur with avid curiosity burning in their eyes. Emma could read their thoughts.
"The head of the Los Angeles Institute, he is weak, unwell."
The inner doors rattled, and Diana came in. She looked cool and calm as always. Her dark gaze took in the scene before her. Her glance brushed over Emma once. There was cold anger in it. "Arthur," she said, "you're needed upstairs. Do go. I will escort the convoy outside to discuss the bargain."
How long was she out there eavesdropping?
Emma wondered as Arthur, looking desperately grateful, limped past Diana and toward the door. Diana was as quiet as a cat when she wanted to be.
"Is he dying?" Erloth asked with some curiosity, his gaze following Arthur as he left the sanctuary.
"We're mortal," Emma said. "We get sick, we age. We're not like you. But it's nothing that should be a surprise."
"Enough," Diana said. "I will lead you from the sanctuary, but first, the translation." She held out a slim brown hand. Kieran handed over the near-translucent papers with a wry look. Diana glanced down at them.
"What does the first line say?" Emma said, unable to stop herself. Diana frowned.
Fire to water, she said. What does that mean? Erloth gave her a single, cool look and moved to join her.
It will be the task of your people to find out.
Fire to water. Emma thought of the bodies of her parents drowned and then crumbling like ashes. Of the body of the man in the alley scorched and then soaked in seawater. She looked at Julian, wondering if his mind was following the same paths as hers. But no, he was looking at his brother, unmoving, as if frozen in place. She itched to get her hands on the papers, but they were folded into Diana's jacket, and Diana was leading the two ferrymen toward the sanctuary exit. "You understand that we will be investigating this without the knowledge of the Clave," she said as Erloth fell into step beside her. Kieran walked behind them, scowling.
"We understand that you fear your government, yes," said Erloth. "We fear them, too, the architects of the Cold Peace." Diana didn't rise to the bait.
"If you must contact us during the investigation, you'll need to take care in doing so." "We will come only to the sanctuary, and you may leave messages here for us," said Kieran. "If we hear that you have spoken of our bargain to anyone outside these walls, especially one who is not Nephilim, we will be most displeased. Mark, too, is under orders of secrecy from the Hunt. You will find he will not disobey them." Sunlight speared into the sanctuary as Diana opened the doors. Emma felt a flash of gratitude for her tutor as Diana and the two fairies vanished outside. Gratitude for sparing Arthur and for sparing Julian one more second of pretending he was all right. For Jules was looking at his brother, finally, really looking at him, with no one to see or judge his weakness. With no one to, at the last moment, take Mark away from him again. Mark raised his head slowly. He was thin as a lath, so much narrower and more angular than Emma remembered him. He didn't seem to have aged so much as sharpened, as if the bones of chin and cheek and jaw had been refined with careful tools. He was gaunt, but graceful in the manner of the Fae. "Mark," Julian breathed out, and Emma thought of the nightmares Jules had woken up from over the years screaming for his brother, for Mark, and how hopeless he had sounded and how lost. He was pale now, but his eyes were shining as if he were looking at a miracle. And it was a sort of miracle, Emma thought. The fairies didn't give back what they had taken. Or at least they never gave it back unchanged. A chill ran suddenly up Emma's veins, but she didn't make a sound. She didn't move as Julian took a step toward his brother, and then another one, and then spoke, his voice breaking. "Mark," he whispered. "Mark, it's me." Mark looked Julian straight in the face. There was something about his two colored eyes. Both eyes had been blue when Emma had last seen him, and the bifurcation seemed to speak to something broken inside him, like a piece of pottery cracked along the glaze. He looked at Julian, taking in his height, his broad shoulders and lanky frame, his tousled brown hair, his blackthorn eyes, and he spoke for the first time. His voice sounded rough, scraped, as if he had not used it in days.
"Father," he said,
and then as Julian drew in a startled breath, Mark's eyes rolled back in his head and he collapsed to the floor in a dead faint. 6. Many Far Wiser. Mark's bedroom was full of dust. They had left it untouched for years after he disappeared. Finally, on what would have been his 18th birthday, Julian had thrown the door of the room open and cleared it out in a savage spree. Mark's clothes, toys, games, all had gone into storage. The room was cleaned out and stripped down, a bare, empty space waiting for decoration. Emma moved around, pushing back dusty curtains and opening windows, letting in light while Julian, who had carried his brother up the stairs, set Mark down on the bed. The blankets were pulled tight, a thin layer of dust across the coverlet. It puffed up as he set Mark down. Mark coughed but didn't stir. Emma turned away from the windows. Open, they flooded the room with light and turned the dust motes in the air into dancing creatures. "He's so thin," Julian said. "He hardly weighs anything at all." Someone who didn't know him might have thought he was expressionless. His face betrayed only a kind of tightening of the muscles, his soft mouth compressed into a hard line. It was the way he looked when he was struck to the heart with some strong emotion and was trying to hide it, usually from his younger siblings. Emma came over to the bed. For a moment, they both stood looking down at Mark. Indeed, the curves of elbows and knees and collarbone were painfully sharp under the clothes he wore. Ragged jeans and a t-shirt gone almost transparent with years in washing. Tangled blonde hair half covered his face. "Is it true?" said a small voice from the doorway. Emma whirled around. Ty and Livia had come into the room only a little way. Christina was in the doorway behind them. She looked at Emma as if to say she tried to hold them back. Emma shook her head. She knew how impossible it was to stop the twins when they wanted to be part of something. It was Livy who had spoken. She looked across the room now, past Emma, to where Mark lay on the bed. She sucked in a breath. "It is true." "It can't be." Ty's hands were fluttering at his sides. He was counting on his fingers, 1 to 10, 10 to 1. The gaze he fixed on his unconscious brother was full of disbelief. "The fair folk don't give back what they take." "No," Julian said, his voice gentle, and Emma wondered, not for the first time, how he could be so gentle when she knew he must feel like screaming and flying apart into 1,000 pieces. "But sometimes they give you back what belongs to you." Ty said nothing. His hands were still fluttering in their repetitive movements. There had been a time when Ty's father had tried to train him to immobility, had held his son's hands tightly at his sides when he was upset and said, "Still, still." It had panicked Ty into throwing up. Julian never did that. He just said everyone got butterflies when they were nervous. Some people got them in their stomachs, and Ty showed his in his hands. Ty had been pleased by that. He loved moths, butterflies, bees, anything with wings.
"He doesn't look like I remember," said a tiny voice.
It was Drew, who had edged into the room around Christina. She was holding hands with Tavi.
"Well," said Emma, "Mark is 5 years older now."
"He doesn't look older," said Drew. "He just looks different."
There was a silence. Drew was right. Mark didn't look older, certainly not 5 years older. Partly it was because he was so thin, but there was more to it than that. "He's been in Fairy all these years," Julian said. "And time. Time works differently there." Ty stepped forward. His gaze raked the bed, examining his brother. Drusilla hung back. She'd been 8 when Mark had gone. Emma couldn't imagine what her memories of him were like. Cloudy and blurred, probably. And as for Tavi, Tavi had been 2. To him, the boy in the bed would be a total stranger. But Ty, Ty would remember. Ty moved closer to the bed, and Emma could almost see the quick mind working behind his gray eyes. "That would make sense. There are all sorts of stories about people vanishing for a night with the fairies and coming back to find 100 years have passed. 5 years could have been like 2 years for him. He looks about the same age as you, Jules." Julian cleared his throat. "Yeah, yeah, he does." Ty cocked his head to the side. "Why did they bring him back?" Julian hesitated. Emma didn't move. She didn't know, any more than he did, how to tell the children who were looking at them with wide eyes that the lost brother who appeared to have been returned to them forever might be here only temporarily.
"He's bleeding," Drew said.
"What?" Julian tapped the witchlight lamp at the side of the bed, and the glow in the room intensified to a hot brightness. Emma drew in her breath. The side of Mark's ragged white t-shirt at his shoulder was red with blood, a patch that was slowly spreading. "Steely," Julian barked, holding out his hand. He was already pulling at his brother's shirt, baring his shoulder and collarbone, where a half-healed gash had opened. Blood was trickling from the wound, not fast, but Tavi made an inarticulate sound of distress. Emma pulled her Steely from her belt and threw it. She didn't say anything. She didn't need to. Julian's hand came up and caught it out of the air. He bent to press the tip to Mark's skin to begin the healing rune. Mark screamed. His eyes flew open, bright and crazed, and he thrashed out at the air with his stained, dirty, bloody hands. "Get it away," he snarled, struggling upright. "Get it away! Get that thing away from me!"
"Mark!"
Julian reached for his brother, but Mark batted him away. He might have been thin, but he was strong. Julian stumbled, and Emma felt it like a burst of pain in the back of her head. She dashed forward, putting herself between the two brothers. She was about to shout at Mark to tell him to stop when she caught sight of his face. His eyes were wide and white with fear. His hand clutched to his chest. There was something there, something that glittered at the end of a cord around his throat. And then he hurled himself off the bed, his body jerking, hands and feet scrabbling at the hardwood. "Move back," Julian said to his siblings, not shouting, but his voice quick and authoritative. They scrambled away, scattering. Emma caught a glimpse of Tavi's unhappy face as Drew lifted him off his feet and carried him out of the room. Mark had darted into the corner of the bedroom, where he froze, his hands wrapped around his knees, his back pressed hard to the wall. Julian started after his brother, then stopped, the steely dangling helplessly from his hand. "Don't touch me with that," Mark said, and his voice, very recognizably Mark's voice, and very cold and precise, was shockingly at odds with the filthy scarecrow look of him. He held them at bay with his glare. "What's wrong with him?" Livy asked in a near whisper. "It's the Steely." It was Julian, voice soft. "But why?" said Emma. "How can a shadow hunter be afraid of a Steely?"
"You call me afraid?" demanded Mark. "Insult me again and find your blood spilled, girl."
"Mark, this is Emma," Julian said. "Emma Carstairs." Mark pressed himself farther back into the wall.
"Lies," he said. "Lies and dreams."
"I'm Julian," Jewel said. "Your brother, Julian. And that's Tiberius?"
"My brother Tiberius is a child," Mark shouted, suddenly livid, his hands clawing behind him at the wall. "He's a little boy."
There was a horrified silence.
"I'm not," said Ty finally into the quiet.
His hands were fluttering at his sides, pale butterflies in the dim light.
"I'm not a child."
Mark said nothing. He closed his eyes, and tears slid out from beneath his lids, tracking down his face, mixing with the dirt. "Enough." To everyone's surprise, it was Christina who had spoken. She looked embarrassed as everyone turned to look at her, but stood her ground, chin up, straight-backed. "Can't you see this is tormenting him? If we were to go into the hall..."
"You go," said Julian, looking at Mark. "I'll stay here."
Christina shook her head.
"No."
She sounded apologetic but firm. "All of us." She paused as Julian hesitated. "Please," she said. She crossed the room and opened the door. Emma watched in amazement as the Blackthorns, one by one, filed out of the room. A moment later, they were all standing in the corridor, and Christina was shutting the door of Mark's room behind her. "I don't know," Julian said immediately as the door clicked shut, leaving him alone in there. "It's his room," Christina said. Emma stared at her in amazement. How could she be so calm? "But he doesn't remember it," Livy said, looking agitated. "He doesn't remember anything." "He does remember," Emma said, laying a hand on Livy's shoulder. "It's just that everything he remembers has changed."
"We haven't."
Livy looked so woebegone that Emma pulled her close and kissed the top of her head, which was no mean feat since Livy was only an inch shorter than her. "Oh, you have," she said. "We all have. And so has Mark." Ty looked agitated. "But the room is dusty," he said. "We threw out his things. He'll think we forgot him, that we don't care." Julian winced. "I kept his things. They're in one of the storerooms on the ground floor." "Good." Christina brought her hands together sharply. "He'll need them, and more. Clothes to replace the ones he's wearing. Anything of his that was kept. Anything that'll seem familiar. Photos or things he might remember."
"We can get those," said Livy. "Me and Ty."
Ty looked relieved to have been given a specific task. He and Livy headed downstairs, their voices a low murmur. Julian, looking after them, exhaled raggedly, mingled tension and relief. "Thanks for giving them something to do." Emma reached out to squeeze Christina's hand. She felt oddly proud, as if she wanted to point to Christina and say, "Look, my friend knows exactly what to do." "How do you know exactly what to do?" she asked aloud, and Christina blinked. "This is my field of study, remember?" Christina said. "Fairy and the results of the cold peace. Of course, the folk have returned him to you with demands. That is part of their cruelty. He needs time to recover, to begin to recognize this world and his life again. Instead, they would thrust him back into it as if it would be easy for him to be a shadow hunter again." Julian leaned back against the wall beside the door. Emma could see the dark fire in his eyes, banked under his lowered eyelids. "They injured him," he said. "Why?" "So you would do what you did," said Emma. "So you would get a Steely." He cursed, short and harsh. so I would see what they did to him, how he hates me. He doesn't hate you, said Christina. He hates himself. He hates that he is Nephilim, because they would have taught them to him, hate for hate. They are an old people, and that is their idea of justice.
How is Mark? It was Diana emerging at the top of the stairs. She hurried toward them, her skirts whispering around her ankles. Is someone in there with him?
As Julian explained what had happened, Diana listened silently. She was buckling on her weapons belt. She had put on boots, and her hair was tied back. A leather satchel was slung over her shoulder.
Hopefully he can rest, she said when Julian finished.
Kieran said the journey here took them 2 days through ferry. No sleep. He's probably exhausted.
Kieran? Said Emma. It's weird calling gentry fairies by their first names. He is gentry, right?
Diana nodded.
Kieran's a prince of fairy. He didn't say so, but it's obvious. Irloth is from the Unseelie court, not a prince. But some sort of court member. You can tell.
Julian glanced toward the door of his brother's room.
I should go back in there.
No, Diana said. You and Emma are going to Malcolm Fade's.
She fished into her satchel and came out with the fairy documents that Kieran had given to her earlier. Up close, Emma could see that they were two sheets of parchment, thin as onion skin. The ink on them looked as if it had been carved there.
Take this to him. See what he can make of it.
Now? Emma said, but...
Now, said Diana flatly.
The folk have given us, 3 weeks. 3 weeks with Mark to solve this, then they take him back.
3 weeks? Julian echoed. That's not nearly enough time.
I could go with them, Christina said.
I need you here, said Diana. Someone has to watch over Mark, and it can't be one of the children, and it can't be me. I have to go.
Go where? Emma demanded. But Diana only shook her head, unforthcoming. It was a familiar wall. Emma had crashed against it more than once.
It's important, was all Diana said. You'll have to trust me.
Julian said nothing. Emma suspected Diana's aloofness bothered him as much, if not more, than it bothered her, but he never showed it.
But this changes things, Emma said, and she fought down the emotion in her voice, the spark of relief, even triumph, that she knew she shouldn't feel.
Because of Mark. Because of Mark, you're willing to let us try to find out who did this.
Yes. For the first time since she'd come into the hallway, Diana looked directly at Emma.
You must be pleased, she said. You got exactly what you wanted.
We've got no choice now. We'll have to investigate these killings. We'll have to do it without the knowledge of the Clave.
I didn't make this happen, Emma protested.
No situation in which you have no choice is a good one, Emma, Diana said, which you will eventually learn. I only hope it isn't too late. You might think this is a good thing that's happened, but I can assure you it isn't.
She turned away from Emma, fixing her attention on Julian.
As you well know, Julian, this is an illegal investigation. The Cold Piece forbids cooperation with the Fair Folk, and certainly forbids what amounts to working for them, no matter the inducement. It's to our advantage to figure this out as quickly and cleanly as we can, so the Clave has as little opportunity as possible to find out what we're doing.
And when it's done, Julian said, and Mark's back, how do we explain that?
Something in Diana's eyes shifted.
We'll worry about that when it happens.
So we're racing the Clave and the courts, said Julian. Fantastic. Maybe there's someone else we can piss off. The Spiral Labyrinth, the Scholomance, Interpol?
No one's pissed off yet, said Diana. Let's just keep it that way.
She handed the papers to Emma.
Just to be clear, we can't cooperate with the Fair Folk, and we can't harbor Mark without reporting it, except obviously we're going to, so the upshot is that no one outside the building can know. And I refuse to lie to the Clave directly, so hopefully we can get this done with before they start asking questions.
She looked at them each in turn, her expression serious.
We have to work together.
Emma,
no more fighting me.
Christina, if you want to be reassigned to another institute, we'll understand. We'd just ask that you keep this to yourself.
Emma gasped.
No!
Christina was already shaking her head. I don't need a new assignment, she said. I will keep your secret. I will make it my secret, too.
Good, Diana said.
Speaking of keeping things secret, don't tell Malcolm how we got our hands on these papers.
Don't mention Mark. Don't mention the fairy delegation.
If he says anything, he'll have me to deal with.
Malcolm's our friend, said Julian. We can trust him.
I'm trying to make sure he doesn't get in trouble if anyone finds out, she said. He needs to be able to deny it.
She zipped up her jacket.
Okay, I'll be back tomorrow. Good luck.
Threatening the High Warlock, Julian muttered as Diana disappeared down the hall. Better and better. Maybe we should head down to Vampire Clan headquarters and punch Anselm Nightshade in the face.
But think of the consequences, Emma said.
No more pizza.
Julian gave her a wry, sideways-looking smile.
I could go to Malcolm's alone, Emma said. You could stay here, Jules. Wait for Mark to...
She didn't finish. She wasn't sure she knew what exactly they were waiting for Mark to do, that any of them knew.
No, Julian said. Malcolm trusts me. I know him the best. I can convince him to keep the secret. He straightened up.
We'll both go.
As Parabatai. As we should.
Emma nodded and caught at Christina's hand.
We'll make it as fast as we can, she said. You'll be all right?
Christina nodded. Her hand was at her throat, her fingers resting on her necklace.
I will watch over Mark, she said. It will be all right. Everything will be all right.
And Emma almost believed her.
Being a High Warlock must pay well, Emma thought, as she always did when she saw Malcolm Fade's house. It looked like a castle.
Malcolm lived up the highway from the Institute, past Cain and Doom Road. It was a spot where the bluffs rose high above, threaded with green seagrass. The house was shrouded by glamour spells, hiding it from mundanes. If you were driving, which Emma was, you had to look hard at a spot between two bluffs, and a silvery bridge that climbed up into the hills would appear. Emma pulled over to the side of the highway. Lines of cars were parked along the sides of the PCH here, most of them surfers, drawn by the wide beach to the west. Emma exhaled, turning the car off.
Okay, she said.
Emma, Julian said.
She paused. Julian had been almost completely silent since they'd left the Institute. She couldn't blame him. She couldn't find words herself. She'd let the distraction of driving take her, the need to concentrate on the road. She'd been aware of him beside her the whole time, though, his head back against the seat, his eyes closed, his fists clenched against the knee of his jeans.
Mark thought I was my father, said Julian abruptly. She could tell he was remembering that awful moment, the look of hope in his brother's eyes, a hope that had nothing to do with him.
He didn't recognize me.
He remembers you 12, Emma said. He remembers all of you as so young.
And you too.
I doubt he remembers me at all.
He unsnapped his seatbelt. Light sparked off the bracelet of sea glass he wore on his left wrist, turning it to bright colors, flame red, fire gold, blackthorn blue.
He does, he said. No one could forget you.
She blinked at him in surprise.
A moment later, Julian was out of the car. She scrambled to follow him, slamming the driver's side door as cars whizzed by just a lane away.
Jules was standing at the foot of Malcolm's bridge, looking up toward the house. She could see his shoulder blades under the thin cotton of his t-shirt, the nape of his neck, a shade lighter than the rest of his skin where his hair had kept it from getting tanned.
The fair folk are tricksters, Julian said without turning. They won't want to give Mark up.
Fairy blood and Shadowhunter blood together? That's too valuable.
There'll be some clause that'll allow them to take him back when we're done.
Well, it's up to him, said Emma. He gets to choose whether to stay or go.
Julian shook his head.
A choice seems simple, I know, he said. But a lot of choices aren't simple.
They began to climb the stairs. The staircase was helical, twisting upward through the hills. It was glamoured, visible only to supernatural creatures.
The first time Emma had visited, Malcolm had escorted her. She had looked down in wonder at all the mundanes speeding by below in their cars, entirely unaware that above them, a crystal staircase rose impossibly against the sky. She was more used to it now. Once you'd seen the staircase, it would never be invisible to you again. Julian didn't say anything else as they walked, but Emma found she didn't mind. What he'd said in the car, he'd meant it. His gaze had been level and direct as he'd spoken. It had been Julian talking, her Jules, the one who lived in her bones and her brain and at the base of her spine, the one who was threaded all through her like veins or nerves. The staircase ended abruptly in a path to Malcolm's front door. You were meant to climb down, But Emma jumped, her feet landing on the hard-packed dirt. A moment later, Julian had landed beside her and reached out to steady her, his fingers, 5 warm lines across her back. She didn't need the help. Of the two of them, she likely had the better balance. But she realized it was something he'd always done unthinkingly, a protective reflex. She glanced toward him, but he seemed lost in thought, barely noticing that they were touching. He moved away as the staircase behind them vanished into its glamour. They were standing in front of 2 obelisks that thrust up out of the dusty ground, forming a gateway. Each was carved with alchemical symbols, fire, earth, water, air. The path that led up to the warlock's house was lined with desert plants, cactus, sagebrush, California lilacs. Bees buzzed among the flowers. The dirt turned to crushed seashells as they neared the brushed metal front doors. Emma knocked, and the door slid open with a near-silent hiss. The hallways inside Malcolm's house were white, lined with pop art reproductions, snaking off in 12 different directions. Julian was at her side, unobtrusive. He hadn't brought his crossbow with him, but she felt the ridge of a knife strapped to his wrist when he nudged her with his arm. "Down the hall," he said. "Voices." They moved toward the living room. It was all steel and glass, entirely circular, giving out onto views of the sea. Emma thought it looked like the sort of place a movie star might own. Everything was modern, from the sound system that piped in classical music to the infinity-edged swimming pool that hung over the cliffs. Malcolm was sprawled on the long couch that ran the length of the room, his back to the Pacific. He wore a black suit, very plain and clearly expensive. He was nodding and smiling agreeably as 2 men in much the same kind of dark suit stood over him with briefcases in hand, speaking in low, urgent voices. Malcolm, seeing them, waved. The visitors were white men in their 40s with nondescript faces. Malcolm made a nonchalant gesture with his fingers, and they froze in place, eyes staring blankly. "It always creeps me out when you do that," Emma said. She walked up to one of the frozen men and poked him thoughtfully. He tilted slightly. "Don't break the movie producer," said Malcolm. "I'd have to hide the body in the rock garden." "You're the one who froze him." Julian sat down on the arm of the couch. Emma slumped down onto the cushions beside him, feet on the coffee table. She wiggled her toes in their sandals. Malcolm blinked. "But how else am I meant to talk to you without them hearing?"
"You could ask us to wait till your meeting is over," Julian said. "It probably wouldn't be a major risk to any lives."
"You're shadow hunters. It could always be life or death," said Malcolm, not unreasonably.
"Besides, I'm not sure I want the job. They're movie producers, and they want me to cast a spell to ensure the success of their new release. But it looks terrible."
He stared glumly at the poster on the sofa beside him. It showed several birds flying toward the viewer, with the caption, "Eagle Explosion 3, Feathers Fly." "Does anything happen in this movie that wasn't adequately covered in Eagle Explosion 1 and 2? Julian asked.
"More eagles."
"Does it matter if it's terrible? Terrible movies do well all the time," Emma pointed out. She knew more about movies than she wished she did. Most shadowhunters paid little attention to mundane culture, but you couldn't live in Los Angeles and escape it.
"It means a stronger spell. More work for me. But it does pay well. And I've been thinking of installing a train in my house. It could bring me shrimp crackers from the kitchen."
"A train?" Julian echoed. "How big a train?"
"Small. Medium. Like this."
Malcolm gestured low to the ground.
"It would go choo-choo."
He snapped his fingers to punctuate the noise, and the movie producers jerked into life.
"Whoops,"
Malcolm said as they blinked. "Didn't mean to do that."
"Mr. Fade," said the older one, "you'll consider our offer."
Malcolm looked dispiritedly at the poster.
"I'll get in touch."
The producers turned toward the front door, and the younger one jumped at the sight of Emma and Julian. Emma could hardly blame him. From his perspective, they must have appeared out of thin air.
"Sorry, gents," said Malcolm. "My niece and nephew. Family day, you know."
The mundanes looked from Malcolm to Jules and Emma and back again, clearly wondering how someone who looked 27 could possibly have a niece and nephew in their teens. The older one shrugged. "Enjoy the beach," he said, and they marched out, brushing by Emma with a whiff of expensive cologne and the rattle of briefcases. Malcolm stood up, listing a bit to one side.
He had a slightly awkward way of walking that made Emma wonder if he'd once been injured and hadn't completely healed. "Everything all right with Arthur?" Julian tensed beside Emma, almost imperceptibly, but she felt it. "The family's fine, thanks." Malcolm's violet eyes, his warlock's mark, darkened before clearing like a sky briefly touched by clouds. His expression as he ambled over to the bar that ran along one wall and poured himself a glass of clear liquid was amiable.
"Then what can I help you with?"
Emma moved over toward the couch. They had made copies of the papers the fairies had given them. She set them down on the coffee table. "You remember what we were talking about the other night?" Malcolm put his glass aside and picked up the papers.
"That demon language again," he said. "The one that was on the body you found in the alley and your parents' bodies?"
He paused to whistle through his teeth.
"Look at that," he said, stabbing his finger at the first page.
"Someone's translated the first line, fire to water."
"It's a breakthrough, right?" Emma said. Malcolm shook his bone-white head of hair.
"Maybe.
But I can't do anything with this. Not if it's a secret from Diana and Arthur. I can't get involved in something like that."
"It's fine with Diana," Emma said.
Malcolm gave her a dubious look. "Seriously, call her and ask." She broke off as a man ambled into the room, hands in his pockets. He looked about 20, tall, with spiked black hair and cat's eyes. He wore a white suit that contrasted crisply with his brown skin.
"Magnus," Emma said, jumping to her feet.
Magnus Bane was the High Warlock of Brooklyn, and also held the warlock seat on the Council of Shadow Hunters. He was possibly the most famous warlock in the world, though you'd never guess it. He seemed young and had been kind and friendly to Emma and the Blackthorns since he'd met them during the Dark War. She'd always liked Magnus. He seemed to bring a sense of infinite possibility with him wherever he went. He looked the same as the last time she'd seen him, down to his sardonic smile and the heavy jeweled rings on his fingers.
"Emma, Julian, a pleasure. What are you doing here?"
Emma darted her gaze toward Julian. They might have been fond of Magnus, but she could tell from Julian's expression, it was quickly hidden, smoothed over by a look of mild interest, but she could still see it, that he wasn't thrilled Magnus was there. This was already going to be a secret Malcolm needed to keep, adding someone else in, especially someone on the council.
"What are you doing in town?" Julian's tone was casual.
"Ever since the Dark War, the Clave has been tracking incidences of the kind of magic Sebastian Morgenstern used," said Magnus. "Energy raised from evil sources, hell dimensions and the like, to draw power and extend life. Nesiomantes, the Greeks called it."
"Necromancy," Emma translated.
Magnus nodded.
"We built a map," he said, "with help from the Spiral Labyrinth, from the Silent Brothers, even Zachariah, that reveals where a necromantic magic is being used. We caught a flare of it here in Los Angeles, out by the desert, so I thought I'd stop by, see if Malcolm knew about it."
"It was a rogue necromancer," said Malcolm. "Diana said she took care of him."
"God, I hate rogue necromancers," said Magnus. "Why can't they just follow the rules?"
"Probably because the biggest rule is no necromancy," Emma suggested. Magnus grinned at her sideways.
"Anyway, it was no big deal for me to stop by here on my way to Buenos Aires."
"What's in Buenos Aires?" said Julian.
"Alec," Magnus said.
Alexander Lightwood was Magnus's boyfriend of half a decade. They could have gotten married under the new laws that allowed shadow hunters to marry downworlders, other than fairies, but they hadn't. Emma didn't know why.
"Routine check on a vampire-worshipping cult, but he ran into some trouble there."
"Nothing serious," Julian said. He'd known Alec Lightwood longer than Emma had. The Blackthorns and the Lightwoods had been friends for years.
"Complicated, but not serious," said Magnus, just as Malcolm pushed himself away from the wall.
"I'm going to call Diana. Be right back," he said, and vanished down the hallway.
"So," Magnus sat down on the couch, in the place Malcolm had just vacated.
"What brings you to the High Warlock of the City of Angels?" Emma exchanged a worried look with Julian, but short of diving across the table and whacking Magnus over the head, inadvisable for so many reasons, she couldn't think of anything to do.
"Something you're not supposed to tell me, I take it."
Magnus templed his hands under his chin. "About the killings." At their surprised looks, he added, "I have friends at the Scholomance. Katerina Loss, for one. Anything about rogue magic or the fair folk interests me." "Is Malcolm helping out?" Julian shook his head, a minute gesture.
"Some of the bodies were fey," said Emma.
We're not meant to get involved.
The cold peace is despicable, Magna said, and the humor had gone out of his voice. Punishing a whole species for the actions of a few. Denying them rights. Exiling your sister, he added, looking at Julian. I've spoken to her. She helped make the map I spoke of. Any magic that global involves the wards.
How often do you talk to her?
Every week, said Jules.
She said you always told her that everything was fine, said Magnus.
I think she was worried you weren't telling her the truth.
Julian said nothing. It was true that he talked to Helen every week. They all did, passing the phone or computer back and forth. And it was also true that Julian never told her anything except that everything was fine. They were all fine. There was no need for her to worry.
I remember her wedding, Magnus said, and there was gentleness in his eyes. How young you both were. Though it wasn't the last wedding I saw you at, was it?
Emma and Julian exchanged puzzled glances.
I'm pretty sure it was, said Julian. What other wedding would it have been?
Said Magnus. Perhaps my memory is going in my old age.
He didn't sound as if he thought that was likely, though. He leaned back instead, sliding his long legs under the coffee table.
As for Helen, I'm sure it's just an older sibling's anxiety. Certainly Alec worries about Isabel, whether it's warranted or not.
What do you think about ley lines? Emma asked abruptly. Magnus's eyebrows flew up.
What about them? Spells done at ley lines are amplified.
Does it matter what kind of magic? Dark magic? Warlock magic? Fairy magic?
Magnus frowned.
It depends. But it's unusual to use a ley line to amplify dark magic. Usually they're used to move power, like a delivery system for magic.
Well, how about that?
Malcolm, returning to the living room, darted an amused look at Emma.
Diana corroborates your story. Color me astonished.
His gaze moved to Magnus.
What's going on?
A light flashed in his eyes, whether amusement or something else, Emma couldn't quite tell. Sometimes Malcolm seemed completely childlike, going on about trains and shrimp crackers and eagle movies. At other times, he seemed as sharp and focused as anyone she knew. Magnus stretched his arms along the back of the sofa.
We were talking about ley lines. I was saying they amplify magic, but only certain kinds of magic.
Magic that has to do with energy transferals. Didn't you and Katerina Loss run into some kind of trouble with ley lines back when you lived in Cornwall, Malcolm?
A vague expression passed over Malcolm's face.
I can't remember precisely.
Magnus, stop bothering Emma and Julian, he said, and there was a tinge of something like annoyance in his voice.
Professional jealousy, Emma guessed. This is my domain. You've got your own hopeless humans in New York.
One of those hopeless humans is the father of my child, Magnus pointed out.
Magnus had not ever been pregnant, but that would have been interesting, Emma thought. He and Alec Lightwood had an adopted warlock child named Max, who was a scintillating shade of navy blue.
And, Magnus added, the rest of them have all saved the world, at least once.
Malcolm gestured toward Julian and Emma.
I have high hopes for these. Magnus's face broke into a grin. I'm sure you're right, he said. Anyway, I should go. Long trip ahead of me, and Alec doesn't like me to be late.
There was a flurry of goodbyes. Magnus clapped Malcolm on the arm and paused to hug Julian and then Emma. His shoulder bumped her forehead as he bent his head, and she heard his voice in her ear, whispering. She looked at him in surprise, but he only let her go and marched toward the door, whistling. Halfway to the door, there was a familiar shimmer and burned sugar smell of portal magic, and Magnus disappeared.
Did you tell him about the investigation?
Malcolm looked anxious. He mentioned ley lines.
I asked him about them, Emma admitted, but I didn't say why I wanted to know, and I didn't mention anything about translating the markings.
Malcolm circled around to look at the paper again.
I don't suppose you'll tell me who untangled the first line, fire to water.
It would help to know what it means.
We can't, Julian said. But I don't think the translator knew what it meant either. You can use it, though, right? To get the rest of the spell or message or whatever it is?
Probably, though it would help if I knew the language.
It's a very old language, Emma said carefully. Older than Nephilim.
Malcolm sighed.
You're not giving me much.
Okay. Old demony language, very ancient. I'll check with the Spiral Labyrinth.
Be careful what you tell them, Julian said.
Like we said, the Clave can't know we're investigating this.
Which means fairy involvement, said Malcolm, amusement flickering across his face as he saw their horrified expressions.
Don't worry, I won't tell. I don't like the cold piece any more than any other downworlder does.
Julian was expressionless. You ought to take up a career playing poker, Emma thought.
How long do you think you'll need, he asked, to translate?
Give me a few days.
A few days? Emma tried to conceal her disappointment.
Sorry, I can't do it any faster. Malcolm sounded genuinely sorry. Come on, I'll walk you outside. I need some air.
The sun had come out from behind the clouds and was blazing down on Malcolm's front garden. The desert flowers shivered, silver-edged, in the wind from the canyons. A lizard darted out from behind a piece of shrubbery and stared at them. Emma stuck her tongue out at it.
I'm worried, Malcolm said abruptly. I don't like this.
Necromantic magic, demon languages, a series of killings no one understands. Working without the Clave's knowledge. It seems, dare I say it, dangerous.
Julian stared off toward the distant hills, silent. It was Emma who answered.
Malcolm, last year we fought off a battalion of Fornius demons with tentacles and no faces, Emma said. Don't try to freak us out about this.
I'm just saying, danger.
You know, that thing most people avoid.
Not us, Emma said cheerfully.
Tentacles, Malcolm. No faces.
Stubborn, Malcolm sighed. Just promise to call if you need me, or if you find out anything else.
Definitely, said Julian. Emma wondered if the cold knot of guilt that she felt at hiding things from Malcolm also sat in his chest. The wind off the ocean had picked up. It caught the dust in the garden and blew it into swirls. Julian pushed his hair out of his eyes.
Thanks for helping, he added.
We know we can depend on you. He headed down the path toward the steps to the bridge, which shimmered alive as he approached it. Malcolm's face had turned somber, despite the bright noon light reflecting off the ocean.
Don't depend on me too much, he said so softly she wondered if he knew she would hear him.
Why not?
She turned her face up to him in the sunlight, blinking. His eyes were the color of jacaranda blossoms.
Because I'll let you down.
Everyone does, Malcolm said, and went back inside his house.
7. The Sounding Sea. Christina sat on the floor outside Mark Blackthorne's bedroom. There had been no sound from inside for what felt like hours. The door was cracked open, and she could see him, curled into a ball in a corner of the room like a trapped wild animal. Fairies had been her area of study at home. She had always been fascinated by tales of the Addas, from the noble warriors of the courts to the duendes who teased and bothered mundanes. She had not been an Idris for the Declaration of the Cold Peace, but her father had, and the story sent a shiver through her. She had always wanted to meet Mark and Helen Blackthorne, to tell them. Tiberius appeared in the hall, carrying a cardboard box. His twin sister was beside him, a patchwork quilt in her hand.
My mother made this for Mark when he was left with us, she said, catching Christina eyeing it.
I thought he might remember. We couldn't get into the storeroom, so we brought Mark some gifts, so he'd know we want him here, said Ty. His gaze moved restlessly around the hall.
Can we go in?
Christina glanced into the bedroom. Mark was unmoving.
I don't see why not. Just try to be quiet and not wake him.
Livy went in first, laying the quilt on the bed. Ty set the cardboard box on the floor, then wandered over to where Mark was lying. He picked up the quilt that Livy had set down and knelt beside his brother. A little awkwardly, he laid the quilt on top of Mark.
Mark jerked upright. His blue-gold eyes flew open and he caught hold of Ty, who gave a sharp, frightened cry like the cry of a seabird.
Mark moved with incredible speed, flinging Ty to the ground. Livy screamed and darted from the room just as Christina hurtled inside. Mark was kneeling over Tiberius, pinning him to the ground with his knees.
Who are you? Mark was saying. What were you doing?
I'm your brother. I'm Tiberius. Ty was wriggling madly, his headphones sliding off to hit the floor. I was giving you a blanket.
Liar, Mark was breathing hard. My brother Ty is a little boy. He's a child. My baby brother. My...
The door rattled behind Christina. Livy burst back into the room, her brown hair flying.
Let him go.
A seraph blade appeared in her hand, already beginning to glow. She spoke to Mark through gritted teeth, as if she'd never met him,
as if she hadn't been carrying a patchwork quilt for him through the Institute only moments before.
"If you hurt Tiberius, I'll kill you. I don't care if you're Mark. I'll kill you."
Mark stilled. Ty was still writhing and twisting, but Mark had stopped moving entirely. Slowly, he turned his head toward his sister.
"Livia?"
Livy gasped and began to sob. Julian would be proud, though, Christina thought. She was weeping without moving, the blade still steady in her hand. Ty took advantage of Mark's distraction to hit at him, connecting solidly with Mark's shoulder. Mark winced and rolled away without striking back. Ty leaped to his feet and darted across the room to join Livy. They stood, shoulder to shoulder, staring at their brother with wide eyes. "Both of you go," Christina said to them. She could feel the panic and worry rolling off them in waves. Mark could clearly feel it, too. He was wincing, opening and closing his hands as if in pain. She bent down to whisper to the twins. "He's frightened. He didn't mean it." Livy nodded and sheathed her blade. She took Ty's hand and said something to him in the quiet, private language they had. He followed her out of the room, pausing only briefly to look back at Mark, his expression hurt and bewildered. Mark was sitting up, panting. His body bent over his knees. He was bleeding from the reopened cut on his shoulder, staining his shirt. Christina began to back slowly out of the bedroom. Mark's body tensed. "Please don't go," he said. Christina stared. As far as she knew, this was the first coherent thing he'd said since arriving at the Institute. He lifted his chin, and for a brief moment she saw beneath the dirt, the bruises, and the scratches, the Mark Blackthorne she had seen pictures of, the Mark Blackthorne who could be related to Livy and Julian and Ty. "I'm thirsty," he said. There was something rusty, almost disused about his voice, like an old motor starting up again. "Is there water?" "Of course." Christina fumbled a glass off the dresser and went into the small attached bathroom. When she emerged and handed the full glass to Mark, he was sitting up, his back against the footboard of the bed. He looked at the glass wryly.
"Water from taps," he said. "I'd almost forgotten."
He took a long swallow and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"Do you know who I am?"
"You're Mark," she said. "Mark Blackthorne." There was a long pause before he nodded, almost imperceptibly.
"No one has called me that in a long time."
"It's still your name."
"Who are you?" he said. "I should remember, probably, but..."
"I'm Christina Mendoza Rosales," she said.
"There is no reason you should remember me, since we have never met before." "That's a relief."
Christina was surprised.
"Is it?" "If you don't know me and I don't know you, you won't have any expectations." He looked suddenly exhausted. "Of who I am or what I'm like, I could be anyone to you."
"Earlier," Christina said, "on the bed, were you sleeping or pretending?"
"Does it matter?" he said,
and Christina couldn't help thinking that it was a most fairy-like reply, a reply that didn't actually answer her question. He shifted against the footboard.
"Why are you in the Institute?"
Christina knelt down, putting her head on a level with Mark's. She smoothed her skirt over her knees. Even when she didn't want them to, her mother's words about how an off-duty shadow hunter must always be neat and presentable echoed in her head. "I am 18, she said. "I was assigned to study the ways of the Los Angeles Institute as part of my travel year." "How old are you?" This time Mark's hesitation went on for so long, Christina wondered if he was going to speak at all.
"I don't know," he said finally. "I was gone. I thought I was gone. A long time."
Julian was 12. The others were babies. 10 and 8 and 2.
Tavi was 2.
"For them it has been 5 years, Christina said. 5 years without you."
"Helen," Mark said.
"Julian."
"Tiberius."
"Livia, Drusilla, Octavian."
Every night I counted out their names among the stars so I would not forget.
"Are they all living?"
"Yes, all of them, though Helen is not here. She's married and lives with her wife."
"Then they are living and happy together."
"I am glad. I had heard the news of her wedding in Faerie, though it seems long ago now." "Yes." Christina studied Mark's face. Angles, planes, sharpness, that curve at the top of his ear that spoke of fairy blood. "You've missed a great deal."
"You think I don't know that?"
heat boiled up in his voice, mixed with bewilderment. I don't know how old I am. I don't recognize my own sisters and brothers. I don't know why I'm here.
You do.